What's the largest public works project in history? The pyramids, the Panama Canal, how about the American Superhighway System? It's named after President Eisenhower, but when Ike took office, he knew nothing about it. The author of a new book, The Big Roads, joins us to talk about the engineers, visionaries, and bicycle salesmen who made the highways what they are. Plus, we all know Freud was the father of psychoanalysis, but did you know he was a cocaine abuser, too? Coming up, Howard Markel joins us to talk about Freud and other surprises in his book, The Anatomy of Addiction. And science fiction, The Origin of Stethoscope. Well, coming up after this break. Stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Well, actually, it's going to be a pretty smooth ride thanks to concrete, asphalt, macadam, and tarmac. Those are the materials that transform the muddy trails and paths that once crisscrossed the U.S., transformed them into our massive system of superhighways, a system that in many ways now defines what the U.S. is. Where would California be without the 405? They say the out there. Or Washington with no beltway. And New Jersey? And what's your exit? The American highways are such a part of our life, probably most of us never stop and think about how the world's largest public works project came to be. And it is the world's largest public works project. It's really a fascinating story. It's filled with mythology like this. You probably heard that it was President Eisenhower, right, who was responsible for the system. It's named after him. Well, he knew virtually nothing about it until he stumbled upon it by accident while in a traffic jam. It's a really fascinating story, and it's told in the new book, The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American highways. Earl Swift is the author, and he is here. He joins us from WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks for having me.
You know, that is a big myth, is it not? We all say it was Eisenhower who created the superhighways.
Oh, it's been, I mean, the fact that it is named after him certainly leaves one with that impression. And I know I grew up believing that it was as much a part of his era as the polio vaccine and you know, Telstar.
Right. Well, I'm going to quote from a page in your book where you put that all to rest. And you say, the Federal Highway Act of 1921, signed into law in November, was the foundation for modern highway building in the U.S. It remains the single most important piece of legislation in the creation of a national network, far more so than the later Interstate Highway Bill, which would not have been possible or necessary without it. Wow.
It's true. Yeah. 1921 is really when we got modern, the modern partnership between the federal government and the states that enabled the country to build the network of highways we have today.
You mean the states were building their own roads and the government was not involved on the state level?
The government was involved, but it was not there was no coordination built into the planning between states. So you had states and federal government sharing the expense of building highways, but you had no overall plan for how these things would link up into a network that made sense. There was no rational vision for the thing. 1921 Act changed that.
And you talked about some of the visionaries about that when Eisenhower got into office, there was a plan that had been well thought out and the whole highway system put on paper already, and he didn't even know about it.
This had already been authorized by Congress. We had an interstate highway system already approved, already on the books. The only thing it lacked was money. And in fact, it had already received a couple of years' worth of funding, although at a token amount at that point. So it was a done deal in every important respect, in planning, conception, in routing. You know, where these highways would go had already been decided, what they'd look like, how fast you'd be able to go on them, and where you'd be able to go on them.
And you told a really interesting anecdote about how Eisenhower stumbled on the plan stuck in a traffic jam one day.
Well, that's one version of the story. He, of course, when he got stuck in that traffic jam, that would have been in 1957 or 58. He was well aware of the system by that time. He had signed the act that had financed it. What he wasn't aware of when he ran into that traffic jam in suburban D.C. was that the interstate highway system that he conceived of, that he thought he was signing into law, was very different from the interstate highway system that had actually been planned back in the 30s and 40s and authorized by Congress. He had no idea that that system would venture into the cities. In fact, he was very much against that.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the creation of the superhighway system in the United States. Talking with Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways. And this book is so chock full of little anecdotes and stories and stuff, it's hard to know where to begin. Let me begin or continue by asking you, who would be considered then the great father of our superhighway system? Who would you credit? I know you talk a lot about Thomas McDonald as being that.
Thomas father. McDonald would probably get my vote as the first among equals of the triumvirate of men I'd most credit. It was an evolution. You know, the interstates evolved from the numbered U.S. highway system that dates to the mid-20s. Those evolved from a very primitive network of mostly dirt auto trails that we had throughout the teens and early 20s. It really started for the purpose of coming up with a line that makes sense with a guy named Carl Fisher, I think, who was an Indiana wild man and speed demon, a bicycle racer, auto dealer. He marketed the first practical automotive headlight, which made him a millionaire, and he built the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with his winnings, and then single-handedly pretty much built the city of Miami Beach. And along the way, convinced a bunch of his automotive buddies to finance a rock highway from New York to San Francisco, the Lincoln Highway, which they did in fact build. And that effort inspired businessmen in other cities to get behind private sector road building as well. And that's how we got this primitive network of auto trails that sprung up in the late teens. McDonald came in as the head of the federal road building effort in 1919, a job he kept for 34 years. He finally retired in 1953. And he turned that primitive network that Fisher and company had conceived into a rational numbered network, a real grid that made some sense, and then oversaw the research in the 20s and 30s that spawned the interstate system and rode herd on the proposal that became the rough blueprint for the interstate system. And then his protege, a guy named Frank Turner, turned that vision into the concrete and steel that started to sprout around the country in the 60s and 70s.
And then you had
those three.
Yeah, and then they had to come up with a numbering system. It's fascinating how you describe how they decided how to number the highways.
Well, they did, because back in the days of the auto trails, the long distance roads in America all had names, like the Lee Highway, the Lincoln, the Arrowhead Trail, and they identified themselves. If you were a driver, you knew when you were on the road you were on, because it had a signature color scheme, and they painted that color scheme in rings on telephone poles. And, you know, they literally blazed the trail that you followed. But after a while, it became so unwieldy, because you had multiple trails overlapping. You had 250 trails around the country, 64 in Iowa alone. And you couldn't keep track of where you were. I mean, the telephone poles were painted from ground to 15 feet up, and trying to figure out one color scheme from the next became a dangerous distraction. So the feds and the state stepped in and decided to take the private auto trails, the associations that promoted these trails, out of the road building business. And they came up, they assigned a committee to come up with a numbering scheme. And a guy named E.W. James probably deserves the most credit for coming up with the scheme they devised in 1926, which was that all north-south highways would be numbered with odd numbers, all east-west highways would have even numbers, and the lowest numbers of each would be in the far northeast corner of the country, up in Maine. So numbers would increase as you went west and south, and it had the advantage not only of being expandable, you know, you could always add more numbers to the system as you built new highways, but it also allowed a motorist to figure out where he was based on an intersection between these, you know, two of these highways. You could roughly kind of pinpoint, you could triangulate your position in the lower 48. Mm-hmm. The interstate system took that same idea and just used a mirror image of it. Again, odd numbers are north-south, even numbers east-west, but the lowest numbers are down in San Diego. Huh. And they increase in numbers as you go east and north.
And then you had the triple digits, which showed that there was like a spur. Like if you had 95, I-95, 195 led into that. Or
On a three-digit number, the right. First number, if it's an odd number, denotes a spur. It means that it connects with the main highway only in one point. Uh-huh. An even number means that it's a loop, and that it connects in two places.
And that gave rise to the Beltway.
Yes, it did.
You talk about an interesting character, architect Lewis Mumford, who was very influential in those days, who started out as a great proponent, defender of the highway system, until he saw the havoc it was wrecking as people wanted to move it into downtown urban areas. And then he turned around, changed his mind.
Mumford is a very interesting guy because he did a complete 180. He, in the summer of 1931, he co-authored a piece in Harper's with a friend of his named Benton Mackay, in which they advocated what we would now consider a limited access high-speed expressway. There were none of them in the country at the time, so this was pretty theoretical stuff that they were advocating. But they described in this piece, the modern interstate experience, pretty much with grade-separated intersections, with development and access to the highway only at certain points. And the interesting thing here is that that Mackay, his co-author in this, was also the guy who proposed the Appalachian Trail a few years before that. Over the course of the next 25 years after the story appears, there were a number of thinkers who were dovetailing on this idea of limited access at the time. But over the next 25 years, Mumford completely shifted his thinking on highways. And as you say, it was especially when he saw the collateral damage caused by trying to ramrod a 200, 300 foot road right of way through a densely settled older city, especially in the east,
and in the poorest neighborhoods, to try to get. And people
most often, but in the case of some road projects, weren't real picky about what kind of neighborhood they blasted through, and that caused Mumford a great deal of heartache. As did his realization over time that building more roads didn't alleviate traffic congestion; it just created more congestion on newer roads. And he came to recognize earlier than most people, I think, that highways are almost like mountains that create their own weather. They fill up as quickly as you build them.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back to talk more with Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads. Stay with us. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcast, website, social media, phone apps. So please give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about highways with Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads. One of the most fascinating aspects of your book is, and because it interests me so personally, is concrete.
Well, you're the first person who said to me, Ira, that is the part of the book that most interested them. So I'm glad to hear it because I was fascinated by concrete.
I love concrete. It never stops curing, I understand, but that's another
that's
story.
That's true. Yeah, it just cooks along. I found out a lot more than I ever expected to know about concrete in the course of doing the book. And one of the things that really surprised me was that this is an ancient technology that we just kind of lost for hundreds of years. This was something that the Romans were very adept at using. And yet we, for the entire first millennium and right up until really the opening of the 20th century, kind of just somehow misplaced that technology completely and didn't get it back in full until 1918. An American engineer named Duff Abrams in 1918 came up with the very simple recipe for modern concrete. There had been a lot of competing theory about what constitutes the correct mix for concrete's various components. And there are only three components. There's cement, Portland cement. There's water, and there's aggregate, which is sand or gravel or whatever it is that you mix to give it body. No one had been able to come up with a way to properly regulate the mixing of this so that you get a predictable result. Mm-hmm. And Abrams was able to do that by just pointing out that after putting together 50,000 some odd batches of concrete, he was able to say that the only thing that, that really determines the strength of concrete is that you use as little water as you possibly can.
Just
in,
enough.
In mixing it. Just enough to make it plastic so that you can mix it. Yeah. Anything more, and its strength just drops off a cliff.
And you talk about the early roads being made out of macadam.
Macadam is just it's gravel of various types, various sizes. Usually you lay down big gravel, and then you lay down little gravel on top of it. You roll it, and voila, you have a macadam road. And it dates from the 1820s, 1830s, and takes its name from a guy, John McAdam, who developed the process. And really what American engineers brought to it was adding either tar or asphalt to the macadam to create bituminous macadam. And that's what we now know as blacktop.
Or tarmac. Tar and macadam.
Tarmac would be the tar
side.
Version.
And
tar is basically just a coal derivative. It's a fake asphalt.
See what you learned from this book. I mean, Susan in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Ira. I always heard that Eisenhower, being of a military mind, required that there be these long straight passages on the interstate system, say a mile long, that could be used as runways in case of some sort of national emergency to be used in the military way. Is that true or an urban myth?
Good question.
That is... Susan, that's sadly an urban myth. It's such a good story. It's a shame it is.
It's kind of a good idea.
Didn't he see in World War II the great Autobahn the Germans had when he was over there and say, I want some of that stuff?
Well, he sure did. Unknowing that, of course, we already had something on the books back here. But in fact, the Air Force would have loved to have seen that, I think. And they approached the Bureau of Public Roads about having a look to see whether it was possible to incorporate an emergency runway system into the interstates, and the Federal Highway folks just found that it could not be done.
In Europe, they have some in Europe, do they not? Some of the highways.
Well, that was, of course, you got to understand the autobahns were designed to be military roads. They were not designed to move people in commerce.
Right.
I mean, they were when they were opened, nobody in Germany had a car. The only people using them were trucks full of soldiers and tanks, and that was amply clear to all of the American highway officials who went over to take a look at them. They admired their construction and design, but to a one, they came away concluding that something like that wouldn't have a lot of utility in the United States because, it was designed to move the German army to the country's frontier so they could wage war on their neighbors. And pretty clearly designed to do that.
Mm-hmm. You've seen a lot of highways and byways. Can you give us an idea of what the state of America's superhighways is today?
It's a bit troubling, really. It varies from state to state. These are state highways. The U.S. interstate highway system is not owned by the federal government. You know, the system is now at or nearing its expected service life and will require a great infusion of capital in the coming years to stay useful, to stay in one piece. We put a tremendous load on this thing. The 47,000-mile system constitutes 1.2% of our highway mileage, and it carries 25% of our traffic. So it's just an incalculable amount of wear that we subject these roads to. And we simply have not done a very good job in quite a few states at making sure that it's up to, that it will continue to be up to the task. What we'll see happen if money isn't forthcoming to fix it is the bridges will be downgraded in what they can carry, and they'll become far less useful. And eventually you'll see stretches of the highway subjected to the same constraints.
They'll close them?
They will limit the amount of weight they can carry.
So heavy trucks won't be able to go on them.
Which is an awfully big piece of the reason that they're useful.
And it's why the interstate highway was built in the first place.
It's a huge piece of the argument for them, you bet.
To go from big city to big city, as opposed to Eisenhower, who thought they should be going to little towns. That's why he was so surprised.
Yeah, well, he envisioned kind of an autobahn system that avoided the cities. You might be able to get into a city off of the interstate system on a spur, but the system itself would avoid the cities. And he was very surprised when he found that that wasn't the case. That the concrete was already being poured when he found that wasn't the case.
Well, there are a lot of great big surprises in your book, Earl. The big roads are the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways. With Earl Swift, we've only had a fraction of the time we need to cover this book. And it's a great book, and it's got all my geeky stuff in it, too, Earl. So.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the details. The beauty is in the details.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
One more time, Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads, Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers Who Created the American Superhighways. Here with me now is Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got this special holiday week?
This is a moldy oldie that we're digging out of the archives, but it's actually a really good one. And it's perfectly appropriate for the day after Thanksgiving, because mm-hmm. if you, like I am feeling like a large pumpkin right now after my meal.
As big as a large pumpkin, yeah.
Then this video is for you. This is a large pumpkin grower, these Atlantic giants. They're these pumpkins that get to be 1,000 pounds. And we go visit Robert Sabin, who lives out in Long Island and is entering his giant pumpkin into the Hicksville Giant Pumpkin Weigh-Off.
Wow. And it's a big competition, isn't it? People come from around the country.
People from around Long Island, for sure, with their giant pumpkins. But there's a parade of giant pumpkins, and we hear how they grow the pumpkins. Robert Sabin has amazing stories about what he's done to protect his pumpkin. So first of all, he has this whole pumpkin patch in his backyard, and he eventually settles on the pumpkin that he's going to put all of his care into. And then he does things like he puts a blanket on it at night.
Oh,
so
really?
I couldn't make this up. keep it warm at night, and you can't overwater it. This is a big problem people have because the skin will crack. You have to be, you know, right, a considerate parent. Mm-hmm. But you can't eat them. My first question was like, oh, pumpkin pie forever. And he was like, no, that's not what these are for.
and it weighs almost 1,000 pounds. That's, you have to get it out of the backyard.
Crane,
right?
Yep.
Crane.
This is actually a really tense moment for these pumpkin growers, is getting it out of the patch, into the truck, and then loading it back onto the scale at the weigh-off. So you see them coming through in cranes. It shouldn't be missed. It's really a feel-good hero story.
And it's our video pick of the week. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. A feel-good pumpkin story.
Yes, that's right.
A success, something make you feel.
All
it's
pumpkin
uplifting.
Stories are feel-good, but.
That's it.
It is uplifting. Yes.
It's uplifting, and he's uplifting the pumpkin. And you'll see that right there in the video on our video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
You might think of cocaine as a party drug from the 70s and 80s, but 100 years before that, in the 1880s, a guy by the name of Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, was suiting up in white tie and gloves, attending soirees in Paris, and snorting a little cocaine to, quote, untie his tongue. Around the same time, Pope Leo XIII gave a special Vatican gold medal to the maker of Vin Mariani, a concoction of Bordeaux wine and cocaine. Pope Leo was said to carry around a flask of the stuff himself. And across the channel, a young surgeon named William Halstead, who pioneered many techniques still used in surgery today, for example, he invented the surgical glove, was investigating the white powder and its anesthetic properties, a potential wonder drug for the surgical profession. And many times, his experiments involved injecting it into himself, cocaine right through the vein, to the point where he became totally hooked, leaving screaming patients in the operating room behind and descending into a month-long cocaine binge. These are just few of the stories in the new book, An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine, a fascinating read about two scientists who abused cocaine and why they were so intrigued by it in the first place. And it was written by our monthly science fiction contributor, Howard Markel, professor of history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back, Howard.
It's great to be here. Good afternoon, Ira.
This is really a fascinating book. What made you decide to take this project on?
Well, I became very interested in seeing addicted patients in my own clinic, and I tend to understand the world as completely as I can as both a historian and a physician, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about the origins of addiction. And as I studied more and more and read more and more, I came across both Sigmund Freud and William Halstead, and I became addicted to their life stories. They were so fascinating. They were so compelling. And I thought, using their lives and their struggles, I could really put a human face on this terrible disease.
Tell us about what there was at that turn of the century, over 100 years ago, that period of time where cocaine seemed to be popping up everywhere. Sigmund Freud, you had it in these doctors, and you had it in Arthur Conan Doyle talking about Sherlock Holmes. The world seemed to, and we hear stories that Coca-Cola was invented around that time.
Absolutely. In the 1880s, even though coca leaves had been chewed by the aboriginals in South America for millennia, around the early 1800s, as European explorers started traveling to South America, they brought some coca leaves back. And they were very impressed by the endurance and the stimulation that came from chewing coca leaves. But over the next several decades in the 1800s, chemists and scientists began to search for that active ingredient. Mm-hmm. What was it that made chewing coca leaves so buzzy and exciting? And indeed, they did find out how to crystallize an alkaloid salt called cocaine hydrochloride. And the drug companies, the pharmaceutical houses of the era, loved it. It was their blockbuster drug. And they sold it as a cure for upset stomach, for flatulence, for consumption, for depression, for morphine addiction. Well, perhaps they oversold it a bit, but it was truly the miracle drug of its era.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Howard Markel, who's author of an incredible new book, An Anatomy of Addiction. And how did Freud discover it and get hooked on it?
Well, Freud, and it was really fun to get to learn about Freud as a young, nervous man who was eager to make his career. We always think of Freud as this icon with that beard and that grim countenance. But he was a nervous fellow and wanted to make good. And he was looking for something that would make his name. And he practiced medicine in Vienna, which was probably the most competitive medical marketplace in the world at that time. The Vienna General Hospital was the place to train. And he knew if he was going to get a professorship, he would have to discover something great. So he read various little case reports in the journals about how great cocaine was for fighting off depression or fatigue. And he found an interesting little report that it could help you if you had morphine addiction. And morphine and opium were terrifically overprescribed back then. And what the medical profession did was create a lot of addicts. And one of Sigmund's best friends, a man named Fleischl Marxo, was a great physiologist who injured his hand. He had to have his thumb amputated. And he had terrible chronic pain. And he became a hopeless morphine addict. So Sigmund wanted to help his friend. He also knew that if he could write this up, he could really become famous. And so he studied this. He began studying it in 1884, read the whole world's literature on the topic, and wrote a very prominent monograph called Über Coca, or On Coca, that really excited the entire medical world about all of its medical and therapeutic uses, except for one. He missed the major use of cocaine as a medical agent. It is a terrific local anesthetic.
Huh. And a few months after Freud got his first shipment of cocaine in 1884, he wrote a letter to his fiancée describing how it feels. Can you read a little bit of that for us?
I thought you'd never ask. Yes, on June 2nd, 1884, it's about a month or two after he started dabbling with cocaine, he writes to Martha Bernays, his fiancée, "Woe to you, my princess. When I come, I will kiss you quite red and feed you till you are plump. And if you are forward, you should see who is the stronger, a gentle little girl who doesn't eat enough, or a big wild man who has cocaine in his body. In my last severe depression, I took coca again, and a small dose lifted me to the heights in a wonderful fashion. I am just now busy collecting the literature for a song of praise to this magical substance."
Pretty racy stuff for that time.
pretty racy indeed. And the great thing about Freud is that he's an inveterate letter writer. And you can really track his entire life through his letters to his fiance, to his friends, to another friend named Wilhelm Fleiss. And he does get rather specific about how magical and exciting cocaine is for him.
We have to take a break. After that, lots more with Howard Markel and his book, An Anatomy of Addiction. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with author Howard Markel about An Anatomy of Addiction. Before we move on to another protagonist in the book, the other Halstead, the other major figure, let me ask you one question I'm sure that comes up all the time and you address, is what did cocaine have to do with Freud and his theories? Did it have any influence and anything like that?
Well, it's a complicated answer. It's yes and no. I mean, there are points in Freud's early cocaine abuse where he was amazed at how loquacious it made him, how it freed up ideas that he thought were locked within his mind. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And, of course, that's what a safer version of that is, free association, where you're simply talking about things and going from topic to topic to try to delve what's in your unconscious or subconscious mind. But I think he quickly learned, both with his friend Fleischl Marxo, who became not only a morphine addict but also a cocaine addict, and also with another patient he nearly killed while treating her with cocaine, that this was a rather toxic substance. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, his most important dream, the dream that became the model for the interpretation of dreams, was indeed a dream about cocaine use and the problems that resulted from treating this patient, Emma Eckstein, with cocaine.
Interesting.
Well, he dreamed that he was at a party and the Emma character came to him, a crowded party, and there were syringes and cocaine and scabs all around, and she accused him in front of this gathering, "You nearly killed me. This is terrible." And Freud wondered about this and said, "Well, I had this dream because I'm such a concerned physician that if any of my patients have a bumpy course, I feel it as well." Well, in reality, Freud had this dream because he was rather upset and nervous that he nearly killed her while treating her, both himself under the influence and while she was taking cocaine. With a surgical mistake, a colleague of his operated on Emma's nose and left a surgical sponge in the site, and she nearly died. So talk about dreams as wish fulfillment. Here's a perfect example of that. So cocaine did have some impact on his thinking and on his life.
Yes, and it certainly had an impact. And the other major protagonist in your book, the renowned surgeon William Halstead, who was a contemporary of Freud's. Tell us about what happened with him.
Well, Halstead, of course, Freud and Halstead probably never met, although they were both working at the Vienna General Hospital at the same time.
I found that hard to believe. As I'm reading your book in these parallel lives, knowing that, I'm saying, well, they never, you know, bumped into the cafeteria or something like that?
Well, you know, I've had fantasies many a night while writing this that they somehow passed each other. And my historian's ethics,
because I have no documentation. Sniffing at each other down the hall.
Yeah, rubbing each other's noses. But I could not find any documentation. Yeah. But they must have seen each other. It's not that big of a place. But Halstead, of course, read not only Freud's very famous paper on cocaine, but a subsequent paper that came out about a month later by a man named Carl Kohler that demonstrated that if you did a cataract operation and you took a dropper full of water and cocaine, you could anesthetize the eyeball. And so Halstead was fascinated that here is a safe local anesthetic that I could use on my operations, because back then they had ether and chloroform, but those were very toxic and obnoxious drugs. They made you throw up a lot. They really caused a lot of sleepiness and sedation. So he started experimenting with that, and he used, as many doctors did, his own arm. He was his own guinea pig, and he was injecting it and very rapidly went down the tubes as a cocaine addict.
To the detriment of his patients, you point out.
Yeah, most you know, he stopped going to the hospital. He stopped going to meetings. He stopped writing. And most infamously, he was called down to see a patient at the Bellevue Hospital. It was a serious fracture, a leg fracture in a laborer who fell off the roof of a building. And Halstead was quite the expert at repairing these types of injuries. And you also have to remember that a broken leg of that magnitude, where the bone was literally sticking out of the skin, was almost always a fatal case if somebody did not intervene immediately. And Halstead was so bombed out of his mind on cocaine that he actually withdrew from the operating table and said, "I cannot operate," and then went home and skittered away the next several months high on cocaine.
Wow. And he eventually had that addiction his whole life.
Well, he did. Around that period, a good friend of his, William Henry Welch, who became one of the founders of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, promised he would bring Halstead with him and in this great medical experiment, but only if he got clean. And first, he tried to take Halstead on an ocean voyage. That didn't work very well. Halstead brought along his own supply of cocaine, and then he broke into the first aid kit when he ran out. And finally, Welch said, "You've got to take care of this. This is a huge problem." And Halstead admitted himself to an insane asylum, the Butler Hospital for the Insane in Rhode Island, and stayed there for many months to try and rid himself of this problem. Unfortunately, he gained another problem because while they were trying to get him off cocaine, they gave him morphine. So he emerged as both a cocaine and a morphine addict for the rest of his life.
So when does cocaine, sort of the dangers of it, get to be recognized and now it's no longer available to anybody who wants to get it?
Well, that happened rather quickly after this big push that it was the miracle drug of all time. And that's one of the exciting things about writing about cocaine is that, you know, you don't have a long period of safe use with that drug. You go downhill pretty quickly if you're abusing it. And within several, you know, a few years, there was a whole cohort of people, and William Halstead was one of them, who are just wrecked men. Many of them were doctors, by the way, but they were wrecked human beings. They were paranoid. They were thin. They were jittery. They couldn't sit still. And they were true cocaine addicts. And the medical literature, beginning in the late 1880s and certainly by the 1890s, said, hey, this is not something we should prescribe willy-nilly. And in fact, by the early 20th century, the United States Congress passed a law controlling things, not just cocaine, but also narcotics such as morphine and opium and even marijuana, that you could not simply sell this stuff over the counter, that you had to have a doctor's prescription in order to obtain it.
After he finally went clean, did Halstead make any more contributions to the surgical field? Was he finished at that point?
No. That's the wonderfully fascinating part of his story, is that Welch really helped him, brought him down to Baltimore. He was his minder. They lived together. They had dinner together, and he took him under his wing. He did not have a surgical position initially at Johns Hopkins. He was in the lab. He was operating on dogs. And he was working on some of his greatest procedures, how you operate on the abdomen, how you operate safely and delicately so that the wounds heal safely, inventing the rubber glove, interesting procedures on breast cancer and thyroid disease. And his most active periods coincided with the times he could lay off the drug. And his most fallow periods, in fact, where he couldn't operate at all, where he'd walk out of the operating room or he'd go AWOL from the hospital entirely and no one knew where he was, you know, coincident with the time where he was abusing at the most point. Now, he probably went on binges of cocaine off and on every summer or so, but he used morphine, a dose of morphine, probably every night for the rest of his life.
Wow. Cocaine, you know, I remember reading about it in Sherlock Holmes's his adventures. What was it, Quick Watson the Needle, that sort of thing? Was
Quick it? Watson the Needle, yes. And Watson always said, why are you taking that drug? It's so dangerous.
did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle know these people, or was it just the times he was living in?
Well, Arthur Conan Doyle was not only a very astute physician, he was also a great medical journalist before he became the novelist that we recall today. And he really kept abreast of the medical literature, the latest scientific and medical discoveries. And so he undoubtedly read Sigmund Freud's Uber Coca. By the way, later on in life, Sigmund Freud was a great Sherlock Holmes fan.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding at all. And so he read Uber Coca, and he likely read because he was interested in eye surgery, he definitely read Carl Kohler's paper about cocaine anesthesia and probably played with it a little bit himself. And, of course, he gave his character Sherlock Holmes, who was based on a doctor. Sherlock Holmes had the diagnostic deductive capability of a doctor, and he gave him as one of his characteristics a love of 7% solution, a 7% cocaine solution that he injected in his mottled arm.
Yeah. Howard, we usually have you on as our guest for science diction, with the origin of scientific words. And, of course, the theme in your book is where does the word addiction come from? You want to give us that?
Yes, and while – yes, of course. And while, you know, Freud and Halsted and the 1880s with cocaine and even morphine, that's the birth of the modern addict as we understand it as a excessive use to the point of loss of control of a substance. It really it wasn't that term – that it didn't mean that at all until the late 19th century. In fact, the word comes from a Latin word, addictio. And in antiquity, it was an edict of Roman law, so that if I owed you a great deal of money, Ira, and I couldn't pay you back, you would take me before a judge, and he would make me your addict, your slave, until I'd have to work for you until I could pay you off. And that was the nature of the term addiction or addict well into the 1500s. Later on, it became a term for describing someone's bad habits, if you ate too much, if you were too stubborn, if you smoked too much. But we don't see its use as the loss of control due to an exogenous substance that you take until the late 1880s or early 1890s.
And it would make sense because of the original definition, as you say, is you're basically enslaved to someone.
Yeah.
And so you're enslaved to this drug. I would imagine.
To this drug, yeah. And now as we're learning more and more about the science of addiction and what these substances and perhaps even behaviors such as hypersexuality or gambling or what have you, these stimulate the pleasure center of the brain, the limbic center of the brain in such a way that it really changes the architecture, the wiring, to put it crudely, of the brain so that you lose the ability to say no.
Yeah.
And you know it's harming you, but you still do it.
And the problem is undoing the wiring. Then.
Exactly. Yeah.
So because, as you say, addiction is something that's physically changed in your brain.
Yeah. So that the first dose or two or 100 may be voluntary. But, once you change a cucumber into a pickle, you can't change that pickle back into a cucumber. So you have to come up with other means, very clever means of medical and psychological treatment to try to help people get off their drugs of choice.
Well, Howard, I'm not clever enough to top that analogy. So,
I think you are. That's
a beauty. And I think, Howard, that's a great place to end the segment and segue into this month's episode of Science Diction. What have you got for us this month, Howard?
Well, the word is stethoscope.
Stethoscope.
Yes.
Huh.
And, doctors have been listening to patients' breath sounds since at least 1500 BC, but it really wasn't until the early 19th century that a French physician named René Laennec systematically investigated the sounds that we make when we breathe and also of our heartbeat. And, the time-honored way of doing that was literally to place your ear on a patient's chest. And Laennec didn't like that. For one, if he had an obese patient, it was very hard to hear through all that fat. And also, he was treating the great unwashed, literally, and they had poor hygiene and sometimes they were lice-ridden, and that sort of disgusted him. So he came up with this invention, the stethoscope, which he was also a Greek scholar, and he took that name from two Greek roots, stethos, which means chest, and scopen, which means to look at or to observe.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Howard Markel, author of An Anatomy of Addiction. The early stethoscope didn't look much like the one we have today, did it?
Not at all. It was a hollow tube made out of cedar or ebony, and there's a really charming story of how that came to be. It was in 1816, he was late to see a patient, a woman with heart disease, and he was taking a shortcut through the courtyard of the Louvre. And he saw some boys playing on a pile of timber. and two boys were playing with a long plank or a log, and one was taking a pin or a nail and scratching it on one end, and the other boy could hear it all the way on the other end, you know, as sound will travel through a solid body. And he thought, wow, that's a great idea. And then he went to see his patient, and he asked for some paper. He rolled it up into a cylinder, and he put it against this woman's chest, and he was absolutely amazed at how he could hear the heart in a way that he had never been able to hear before.
Wow. But even if they could hear, you know, something rattling around in the chest, in those days, was there anything you could really do about it?
Well, back then, diagnosis was more important than treatment. They didn't have a lot of treatment. But what was really remarkable about Laennec is that he figured out so many things about diseases of the chest, you know, things like tuberculosis or emphysema, and also of heart disease, whether they were heart murmurs or other problems of the heart, so that doctors could accurately diagnose these. And he experimented with a series of tubes, hollow tubes. It's about a foot to a foot and a half long. And he wrote a textbook called On the Practice of Auscultation. Now, auscultation comes from the Latin auscultare, which means to listen. So it's on the practice of listening. It was published in 1819. It was a bargain at 13 francs because you also got a stethoscope with it.
Wow.
But it took a while for it to catch on. The book had to be translated in different languages. And finally, it became the iconic symbol. And by about 1851, the binaural stethoscope, the what's very familiar to people today with the two ear prongs and the tubes began to develop. And that became the stethoscope as we know it.
Yeah, is the stethoscope as we know it becoming obsolete? You know, we have all this imaging technology.
Sadly, yes. I still know how to use my stethoscope, and I remember avidly listening to tapes of heart sounds and breast sounds so that I could learn them on real patients. And it is sad. With all our wonderful, you know, non-invasive imaging techniques, you know, we can learn more and more about a patient without ever being in the room. And that's kind of sad because as that distance has grown, we've lost something. And I think maybe we ought to hang on to our stethoscopes a little bit longer to remind that one of the principal aspects of being a doctor is listening to our patient.
All right, Howard, thank you very much.
Well, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Howard Markel is a professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine. Laura Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Plato. Thanks for listening.